Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Brian Lynn, and Steve Ember. But first, this report. When a student arrives at a college or university, they are likely to face many difficulties as they work towards earning their degree. Being far from their home, working a job in addition to the demands of their study programs, and making friends are just a few of the issues they might deal with. Yet what many students may not expect is just how hard it can be to meet the academic expectations of their professors. Fuji Lozada says many students feel that simply gaining acceptance into a school is proof that they are ready for the requirements of their programs. But the truth is that almost every student, no matter the quality of their past educational experience, needs help, he says. That is why almost every college and university in the United States offers some kind of service to help students succeed with their studies. Lozada is the director of the John Crosland Jr. Center for Teaching and Learning at Davidson College in Davidson, North Carolina. The center is similar to offices at many schools around the country that provide services to help students. The center has some full-time employees, but is mainly operated by students who are trained to assist others. These student assistants can gain a lot, too. By helping others in areas where they might have experience, students strengthen their own understanding of their field of study, Lozada says. When students first come to college, they still are in this mode of, I'm here to learn by myself. But academics is really a team sport, he told VOA. He notes that one area students often struggle with is writing. Most American high schools teach students shorter forms of writing, often working in the five-paragraph essay form. College professors, however, expect students to be able to write about subjects at much greater length. They also expect students to present complex arguments supported with lots of research. While a student might be skilled in other areas, if they are not used to this kind of writing, they can quickly find themselves falling behind their peers, says Lozada. International students can especially face difficulty writing at the level expected by American professors, even if their general English skills are strong. That is because U.S. schools have strong rules about how outside research is presented. And professors want students to be critical in their examination of all research. Lozada notes that colleges and universities do not want their students to fail. The problem is that many students either do not know their school has offices like the Crosland Center that are designed to help them, or they are afraid to admit they may need help. When we check with students as to why they didn't come in for tutoring, they assume that nobody else is getting help. And so, actually, once they see that many students are coming, meeting with other students for peer tutoring, that usually gets them in the door, Lozada said. The first step for any struggling college student is to recognize they are having some difficulties, he says. Then they should ask their professors for advice on the areas in which they need to improve and seek out their college's academic support services. Lozada adds that one visit to such a center will not immediately solve the problem. Improving writing skills, for example, takes time. The same can be said about mathematics, computer science, or any other subject. He notes that about 40% of the Davidson students who seek academic support are first-year students. But about 13% are students in the final year of their programs, still asking for help with high-level classwork and major projects. Even when I write a piece, I ask a peer or friend to read it, and then they critique it, Lozada said. That's the kind of academic experience we want to encourage. I'm Pete Musto.
Now it's time for Words and Their Stories, a program from VOA Learning English. Today, our show is about control. Not self-control, but instead, controlling others. We begin with a short story set in a candy factory in the city of Chicago, Illinois. The president of the candy company was Susan Cleveland. Her grandfather started Cleveland Candies as a small business in the downtown part of the city. Over the years, it became a favorite stop for candy lovers of all ages. Susan's father began working in the factory at age 19. He began at the bottom, cleaning floors and counting inventory, and worked his way all the way to the top. By age 30, he was president of the company. Because he started at the ground floor, he knew everything about the candy industry. His employees knew this and respected him for it. As a leader, he was fair but firm. He paid employees well and treated them well too. But he kept them all on a very short leash. He made all the decisions involving the company. He also kept his daughter Susan on a very short leash. When she began working at the company, he refused to let her make any decisions or take on any responsibilities. But no one criticized the president. He knew exactly how to make the business a success, and it worked. The company expanded under his leadership. Soon, Cleveland Candies had stores across the country and even shipped candy all over the world. Then he died suddenly. Control of the company went to Susan. Because her father had kept her on such a short leash, she had no idea how to run the company. It soon stopped earning a profit. One by one, Cleveland candy stores began closing. After 5 years, the company was no more. If Susan's father had passed the torch to her, mentored her, and taught her how to run the company, things might have ended very differently. Now, what do you think to keep someone on a short leash means? A leash is like a rope. People use a leash to walk a dog. The leash keeps the dog from running away or getting into trouble. Keeping a dog on a short leash makes it easier for the dog walker to stay in control of the pet. So keeping someone on a short leash means to control them. Now, in the candy store story, you also heard the expression, pass the torch. If someone is willing to pass the torch, they are willing to give control, give responsibility to someone else. and they usually will not keep people on a short leash. And that brings us to the end of this Words and Their Stories. If you enjoyed the program, remember to join us again next week. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
A new study has found that replacing fossil fuel power systems in the United States could cost up to $4.7 trillion. The study was released by energy research company Wood Mackenzie. The company is based in Edinburgh, Scotland. The report includes one of the first independent cost estimates for completely ending power sources that produce carbon pollution. Some American politicians support the complete replacement of all fossil fuel-based energy sources in the United States with zero carbon systems. The study estimates this could cost at least $4.7 trillion and could present major economic and social difficulties. The total would amount to about $35,000 per U.S. household, the study found. Several Democratic presidential candidates have proposed their own plans to reach the goal of zero carbon emissions. Former Vice President Joe Biden has said his plan would cost about $1.7 trillion. Another candidate, Beto O'Rourke, has proposed a $5 trillion plan to get to zero emissions. Democratic U.S. House member Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who represents New York, helped create a Green New Deal proposal that seeks to solve several major environmental issues. It has been estimated to cost around $10 trillion. Such ideas seek to appeal to a growing sense of urgency about climate change on both sides of the political divide. But many Republicans, including President Donald Trump, have criticized the Democratic proposals as being costly and impossible to carry out. They say the plans would harm the economy. A public opinion study released last week by Reuters Ipsos showed that most Americans support aggressive climate change action like that proposed by Democrats. But that support falls sharply if individuals sense the plans would personally cost them. Wood Mackenzie's report centers only on the costs to replace fossil fuel sources used to generate power. One of the main fossil fuel sources for U.S. power plants is coal. Coal plants give off air pollutants and heat-trapping gases that have been linked to climate change. The study said the change from fossil fuels to green sources would require a complete redesign of the current power system. It estimated that 1,600 gigawatts of wind and solar capacity would have to be added at a cost of around $1.5 trillion. That is more than 11 times the nation's current wind and solar capacity. Even though the costs of wind and solar have been dropping, a sharp increase in demand could drive prices up, the study noted. The report estimated that more than 320,000 kilometers of electrical wires would have to be added to carry wind and solar energy from rural areas to major cities. The estimated cost for that effort would be about $700 billion. The study noted that major costs could be reduced if the process of completely moving away from fossil fuel sources took place over a longer period of time. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Embert. Ronald Reagan was finishing his second term. He was America's 40th president and one of the most popular. During his 8 years in office, many Americans did well financially. Many felt more secure about the future of the nation and the world. The possibility of nuclear war with the Soviet Union did not seem as great a threat as it had in the past. The Constitution limits presidents to 2 terms. So in 1988, the country prepared to elect a new chief executive. There were 3 main candidates for the Republican Party nomination. They were George Herbert Walker Bush, Bob Dole, and Pat Robertson. Bush had just served 8 years as Reagan's vice president. Dole was the top Republican in the Senate. Robertson was a conservative Christian who had his own television program. Ronald Reagan's popularity helped George Bush gain the Republican nomination. Neither Dole nor Robertson won enough votes in the primary election season to be a threat. Bush was nominated on the first vote at the party convention. The delegates accepted his choice for Vice President, Senator Dan Quayle of Indiana. 8 candidates competed for the nomination of the Democratic Party. One of the candidates was Jesse Jackson, a black minister and political activist. He won about 25% of the delegates. He had also sought the nomination 4 years earlier. The Democrats chose Michael Dukakis, the governor of Massachusetts. His running mate was Senator Lloyd Benson of Texas. In public opinion surveys, Dukakis looked like a strong candidate after the party conventions. But then he began to lose popularity. Many observers said he had waited too long to launch a nationwide campaign. The candidates heavily attacked each other through campaign advertising on television. Dukakis came under attack from the Bush campaign, targeting his record as governor. Campaign ads said Dukakis had not been tough enough with criminals.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
Ads by the Bush campaign also said Dukakis would weaken America's military power. And they accused him of not protecting the environment by seeking a permit to dump sewage from Massachusetts off the coast of New Jersey.
The Environmental Protection Agency called Boston Harbor one of the dirtiest harbors in America. But not long ago, Governor Dukakis proposed a way to help clean it up by dumping Massachusetts sewage sludge off the New Jersey shore, just 106 miles from New York. Now Michael Dukakis says he wants to do for America what he's done for Massachusetts. New Jersey can't afford to take that risk.
I'm fed up with it. Never seen anything like it in 25 years of public life.
Dukakis fought back.
George Bush's negative TV ads, distorting my record, full of lies, and he knows it.
Dukakis accused Bush of not telling the truth about his part in the secret sales of arms to Iran to finance Contra rebels in Nicaragua. He also criticized Bush for being part of an administration that reduced social programs.
I must have been living through a different 8 years than the one that the vice president's been living through, because this administration has cut and slashed and cut and slashed programs for children, for nutrition, for the kinds of things that can help these youngsters to live better lives. Has cut federal aid to education, has cut Pell Grants and loans to close the door to college opportunity on youngsters all over this country. And that, too, is a major difference between the vice president and me.
In the end, Bush's campaign succeeded in making Dukakis look weak on crime and defense. Dukakis did not help himself with a commercial in which he was looking out of a moving tank while wearing a large helmet. Many people made fun of the ad. On Election Day in November, Bush defeated Dukakis by almost 7 million votes. George Bush was sworn into office on January 20th, 1989.
No president, no government can teach us to remember what is best in what we are. But if the man you have chosen to lead this government can help make a difference, if he can celebrate the quieter, deeper successes that are made not of gold and silk, but of better hearts and finer souls, if he can do these things, then he must. We as a people have such a purpose today. It is to make kinder the face of the nation and gentler the face of the world. My friends, we have work to do.
George Bush was the son of a United States senator and had led a life of public service. He joined the Navy when America entered World War II. He flew attack planes. He was just 18 years old, at that time the youngest pilot the Navy ever had. He flew many bombing raids against the Japanese in the Pacific. He was shot down once and rescued by an American submarine. George Bush came home from the war as a hero. He became a university student and got married. He and his wife, Barbara, then moved to Texas, where he worked in the oil business. He ran for the United States Senate in 1964 and lost. 2 years later, he was elected to the House of Representatives. He ran for the Senate again in 1970 and lost again. But by that time, he had gained wider recognition. Over the next 8 years, he was appointed to a series of government positions. He was ambassador to the United Nations. He was chairman of the Republican National Committee. He was America's representative in China before the two countries had diplomatic relations. And he was head of the Central Intelligence Agency. In 1980, Bush ran against Ronald Reagan for the Republican nomination for president. Bush lost, but became Reagan's running mate. After two terms as vice president, he felt ready to lead the nation himself. The new president took 7 foreign trips during his first year in office. In Europe, Bush met with the other leaders of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. He proposed a major agreement on reducing troops and non-nuclear weapons in Europe. The Soviet Union considered his proposal an important step in the right direction. In June of 1989, the Chinese government sent tanks and troops to crush pro-democracy protests in Tiananmen Square in Beijing. Hundreds and perhaps thousands of demonstrators were killed. President Bush took some steps against China, but many critics felt the sanctions were not strong enough. In Central and Eastern Europe, communist governments also faced protests. Since 1987, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev had let countries in the Warsaw Pact experiment with political and economic reforms. But those reforms were not enough to stop the fall of communist governments in one country after another. In the summer of 1989, President Bush visited Hungary and Poland. Both nations were trying to develop free market economies. Both were suffering as they moved away from central control.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
In Poland, the leader of the Solidarity Trade Union, Lech Wałęsa, led the push for reform. He would later become president of a democratic Poland.
Hier ist das erste deutsche Fernsehen mit der Tagesschau.
November of 1989 brought a dramatic expression of the changes taking place in Eastern Europe.
Guten Abend, meine Damen und Herren.
On November 9th, East Germany opened the wall that had divided it from the West since 1961.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings, reporting tonight from Berlin.
From the Berlin Wall specifically, take a look at them. They've been there since last night. They are here in the thousands. They are here in the tens of thousands. Occasionally they shout, Die Mauer muss weg, the wall must go. Thousands and thousands of West Germans come to make the point that the wall has suddenly become irrelevant. Something, as you can see, almost a party on. How do you measure such an astonishing moment in history? The East German government said tonight they were going to make more openings in the wall, at least a dozen more, put bulldozers right through the wall so that more people could cross to the West. The East German communist leadership tonight said there'd be a new election law guaranteeing secret elections which the rest of the world could monitor. And only 24 hours after East Germans were told they could go anywhere, anytime, the Soviet Union said, that was a sensible move.
Within days, citizens and soldiers began tearing down the wall as the world watched with hope for a new era of peace.
Now, what's it feel like to be standing on top of the wall?
Incredible for me. It's I can't describe really my feelings. It's something unreal for me.
If there is someone who sleeps for 8 weeks and you told him what happened here, he thinks you're crazy. It's unthinkable. Put my number.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.